I'm a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council, and I'm here to discuss Iran, the U.S. attitude toward Iran. We're going to talk about the Israeli attitude, whether there's a prospect for war, something about the internal decision-making within the Islamic Republic. So we'll begin with the U.S. attitude, which is one, I think, of focusing on sanctions, pressure, firmness, but not trying to be too provocative. In recent weeks, we've seen Iranian threats to close the Strait of Hormuz. We've seen Iranian military maneuvers, an explicit threat to American warships not to come back into the Persian Gulf. And the United States, in response, has said that it will maintain the freedom of navigation in the Persian Gulf. But it's also being very careful, I think, not to make threats, specific military threats, against the Iranian nuclear program. So it's a tense time. My personal view is that we're not yet headed toward a hot war, but we do have to be aware that sometimes things can happen when you least expect it, and we have to be careful that all this escalatory rhetoric doesn't lead to something more dangerous. Now I'll turn over to Meyer, who will tell you something about himself and what the view is from Israel.
Hello, my name is Meir Javedanfar. I teach the Contemporary Iranian Politics course at the Interdisciplinary Center, IDC, in Herzliya. I'm also a regular contributor to The Diplomat. Here in Israel, it really depends who you listen to in terms of the view regarding Iran. You know, in Israel, we have many different points of view. It seems to me that the government right now is still continuing with its calls for the international community to keep on pressuring Iran, and that the Iranian government should be isolated. I think the government of Israel is, this is my take on it, is very happy with the recent sanctions that the United States has imposed against Iran. President Obama just did that. But in Israel, you know, we have, there's a concern for war. I don't think war with Iran is something that the Israeli public is looking for. In Israel, there's a genuine concern about Iran because it's not a competition with Iran in another country. When Iran was financing bus bombings here in Israel, many Israelis died on the streets of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, and that made people very wary of Iran, and they see the Iranian threat as a direct threat towards the state of Israel. Now, there are some people who think it's an existential threat, and some people think who think it's not, but it is a threat generally in Israel. And as we go forward, I'm not sure that there's going to be a war. I think, despite the fact that Israeli politicians are not heaping praises on President Barack Obama, and I don't think they would be doing that, I think they are quite pleased with the way things are going. Despite all the complaints you hear in the press about people saying, oh, the world is not being serious with Iran. In fact, I don't think Israel has ever been in a better position with regards to Iran in the international community. The support we get in Israel with regards to Iran is phenomenal, which makes a nice change because it's the exact opposite when we talk about the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, but that's another topic for conversation. But we have a tremendous support. And I think, you know, the dual policy of President Obama's sanctions and diplomacy should be continued. And I think, as I said, despite the fact that the Israeli politicians don't show that they're happy, I think quite probably they are pleased with the way things are going.
Yeah, Meir, you said a couple of interesting things. First, when you talk about differences of opinion, it's my impression that the current head of the Mossad and previous heads of the Mossad have all said that an Israeli preemptive strike on Iran would be lunacy. And I wonder if that's because they're afraid of the impact of a war or whether they believe that Israel is really not capable of doing sufficient damage to the Iranian nuclear program to make that worthwhile. And if I may add one other comment, you mentioned the bus bombings and so on. It seems to me that the real existential threat, if there is one, to Israel comes not from an Iranian nuclear weapon, but from Iranian support for terrorism. That's what really frightens Israelis. Do Israelis actually think that Iran would use a nuclear weapon against Israel?
Great questions there. I'll start with the first one. What we've had is one head of the a former head of the Mossad, Mr. Meir Dagan, saying that it would be a mistake, it would be, you know, a complete mistake.
Stupid.
Stupidity is actually to attack Iran. We've had another former head of Mossad, Ephraim Halevi, who actually said that that Iran is not an existential threat, and he also backed Meir Dagan in saying that Iran is not an existential threat. And last week we had the current head of the Mossad, Mr. Tamir Pardo, he was quoted in Haaretz saying that Iran is not an existential threat.
Right.
So we have that school of thought. Now, I don't know why they are saying it. I can only make assumptions. And I think the assumption that they're going on is, yes, Iran is a danger, but, you know, let's not frighten the Israeli public, because this is exactly what... First of all, it's exactly what Ahmadinejad and Khamenei want, which in a way we're doing their job for them, and we don't want to be doing that. And number two, it's because, you know, we shouldn't forget that, you know, the more we do this, the more hysteria we create, the more it's going to damage Israel's position, and we're not as weak. We don't want Israelis to get up and leave the country. So I think this is based on their assumption, and also because, again, and this is, I'm making a pure assumption here, that maybe they think that we're not as close to a nuclear Iran. Maybe they don't think that. Maybe they're saying that, yes, Iran wants a bomb, but they're not close. But one thing I'm struck by, and this is something I've been saying this since 2005 here in Israel, is, and they're saying it also, is that Iranian leaders are not crazy. And they're not crazy. Mr. Khamenei, as much as he's an abuser of human rights, and I think I'm speaking, allow me to speak as an Iranian here for a moment, which I am, we're going to be studying in history books, our children and their children's children are going to be studying this period of Iranian history as one of the darkest in modern Iranian history, what is going on there. But there's a difference between mad and bad.
Very good.
The Iranian regime is bad, but it's not mad. These people who are running the country are too obsessed with their corrupt lifestyle of sending their children to study in London like Mohsen Rezaei, or going shopping in London like Mr. Haddad Dadel, the former head of the Majlis, or Khamenei's family and, you know, all the Revolutionary Guard people going shopping in Dubai and then coming back and schwitzing about which hotel they stayed at and what mobile phone they bought. These people, I don't think, are about to give it up for the Palestinians. I don't see it. But at the same time, why is it that Israelis don't want to live under, you know, why are they concerned about Iran? Of course, it's the question of terrorism, which is very serious. But also, Barbara, you know, again, let me give you an Iranian example to this. Many Iranians leave Iran because they don't want their lives to be subject of the economic and politics of the economic politics and the politics of the Iranian regime. They don't want to be subject to the decision making. Many Israelis here, and I think they're quite right, despite the fact that they don't think the regime is going to use a nuke, don't want to be subject to a decision that maybe or maybe not Khamenei would use it.
Mm. Yeah.
They don't want to live with it.
Yeah.
They just don't want to live with it. And I have to tell you, as much as me and other Iran experts here can go around and say Ahmadinejad is weak, and he is weak, and Khamenei is not suicidal, and he's not, at the end of the day, it's the Iranian leadership, more than anybody else, who has convinced the Israelis that this regime cannot be trusted with a nuclear bomb, even if they're not going to use it.
Now, you've made very good points. You remind me of something that Ephraim Sneh, the former defense minister, said some years back. He said that if Iran got a nuke, the real existential threat to Israel would be that all of the intelligentsia, those with wealth, would leave Israel because of that concern over the tiny possibility that Iran might actually use a nuclear weapon. And that was the threat to the Israeli state. It was the psychology and the mentality of the Israeli people. So I think it's good that Mossad chiefs are now saying Iran with a nuke is not an existential threat, that they're trying to tamp down the level of hysteria. Because if Iran actually does achieve a nuclear weapons capability, let's face it, we're probably going to live with it. My sense...
But it won't be easy, Barbara.
It won't be easy, but we've lived with crazy regimes in the past. Meyer.
But let's hope it stopped. Let's
more
hope
crazy
it stopped,
regimes.
No?
You know, we've lived with North Korea. We've lived with Maoist China with nuclear weapons. So I'm not saying this is an outcome we desire, but I think it's one we can live with. I was just at an event at the Atlantic Council where the new British Defense Secretary spoke, and I asked him whether there was any thought to any kind of preemptive action against the Iranian nuclear program, and he said absolutely not. So the world, the West, is counting on sanctions to do the job. And I think the next question I would pose and think about is whether sanctions can do the job. We've seen Iran being put under enormous pressure. You talked about the legislation that President Obama has signed into law, which would forbid foreign banks from dealing with the Iranian Central Bank. And what this is, in effect, doing is forcing the European Union now to impose an embargo on Iranian oil. Some 450,000 barrels a day that Europe purchases, and the European Union is now moving toward a complete embargo on Iranian oil. It's something like, I think, 18% of what Iran sells. So it's a significant step. And we've also seen in recent weeks a tremendous collapse of the Iranian currency. The rial was about 10,000 to the dollar last year. Now it's down, hovering around 17,000 to the dollar, even worse. So I'm curious whether you think these kinds of pressures are really going to make Iran come back to the negotiating table in a serious way. And also, do you see a strategy on the side of the international community, some kind of diplomatic strategy that actually would allow Iran to have a face-saving way to come back to the table and negotiate seriously?
To answer that question, Barbara, there's one concept that it has to be addressed here. It's extremely important that it's addressed before I can answer that question. In my opinion, majority of Iranian people support the nuclear program. Majority, overwhelming majority. But I think amongst them, more and more every day, and not because of President Obama, because of the behavior of this regime itself, they're asking the question, do we want to have a nuclear program with the strategy that the government is pursuing, one which is of isolation, confrontation, bringing economic misery? And I think that more and more in Iran, more people are asking themselves whether Khamenei's strategy is the right one. More important than that, I think most probably there are people within the regime today, Barbara, who are not happy with the way the nuclear file is being handled by the supreme leader, that the costs are simply too high. There are other ways of achieving nuclear energy for Iran, which is its absolute right, and nobody can deny that. There's the cost versus benefit analysis right now that Khamenei is operating on is seriously skewed, and I think the costs are high and there are people who are not happy. Now, how can we empower those people? There are two things that one is being done and one that should be done far more. One is the sanctions, which is an evil necessity. Of course, nobody wants to make the lives of Iranians miserable. I'm not happy with some aspects of this sanction. Why shouldn't some Iranian family who's got their son studying in Malaysia not be able to send money through to him? That's not good. But as a whole, sanctions are necessary to bring this regime back to the table. Now, sanctions could work if we can convince the people who think that the cost right now is too high to come to Khamenei. But more important than that, Barbara, far more important than that, is if President Obama keeps the door of negotiations open. Woe and behold if we make the mistake of cutting negotiations with Iran. That is the biggest mistake, and I think President Obama should keep the door open, should speak to the Iranians on every single occasion that he gets. Every time the Iranians put an offer on the table, let's talk to them. We got nothing to lose. I'm not optimistic. I don't think there will be a miracle. But every time you speak with the Iranians, you strengthen those who want a better way. Not Khamenei's way, a better way. And I think diplomacy must be strengthened. President Obama must strengthen.
I agree with you. I've been very, very disappointed with the Obama administration in recent months. I feel that they've simply abandoned engagement as a strategy. There was a speech that the National Security Advisor, Tom Donilon, gave at the Brookings Institution last month, in which he listed five options for dealing with Iran, and none of the five was diplomacy. Diplomacy was in between hyphens in the fifth option, which was the military option. And I agree with you, we have absolutely nothing to lose. It's not a sign of weakness. And I'm afraid that particularly because of our presidential election politics, there is simply not any diplomatic energy, any real energy being given to try to craft some kind of proposal that the Iranians might be able to accept, something that would allow them to save face, but that would put verifiable curbs on the uranium enrichment program. And I think we really need to take advantage of all this pressure. I agree with you. If there's just pressure, you know, then it's going to really force Iran into a more defiant posture. They will race toward trying to get a weapon, hoping that this will provide deterrence against attack. After all, it worked for North Korea. And we will lose another opportunity, perhaps, to resolve this crisis peacefully. It's very tricky, and we can talk a little bit, maybe, if you like, about the internal dynamics in Iran and how difficult it is now for the Iranian regime to make decisions that will stick. There is, of course, tremendous infighting. Iran's about to have parliamentary elections. The president is against the supreme leader. Their various followers are at each other's throats. But the supreme leader, as the title suggests, can still make a decision if he thinks it's in Iran's interest. So how do we influence the supreme leader? How do we get to him and tell him that there is a way out of this mess for Iran if it's willing to seriously engage?
To be absolutely fair, Barbara, I think Iran also deserves criticism for the negotiations. I think they are very responsible for the way negotiations have not worked. I also blame them. In fact, I blame them even more. I think President Obama went far more than the Iranians. He basically agreed to speak to Iran without any preconditions. When he made that Geneva offer, he did not talk about uranium enrichment as a precondition, and Iran still refused it. And I think after that there have been other efforts. United States does still back the 5+1negotiations with Iran. And you know, last January when they met in Istanbul, they met on Friday. Mr. Jalili turns up at 12 o'clock, then he says, I'm going praying. He has to go to pray. He takes 3 hours. He goes praying for 3 hours. He takes a nice tour of the mosque of Istanbul, the major mosque. He comes back and he says, oi, I've got a headache. I've got a migraine. I can't talk. I've got a problem. I've got a migraine. And then Lady Ashton threatens to call the whole thing off. And then he says, okay, let's talk. And within 2 hours, the EU decided there's nothing to talk about. So the Iranians are also responsible. But President Obama, the strategy from now to get to the supreme leader has to be there's sufficient sanctions to make the regime pay financially, and at the same time to empower those within Iran, and I think even those within the system today, even though the reformists have been purged, to empower them to show Khamenei that unless there is another way, the regime itself could face economic collapse. Because you know what, Barbara? In my heart of hearts, I don't think Khamenei wants good relations with the United States unless he's forced into it. I don't think he does, because he knows friendship with the United States could mean embassy could mean human rights, could mean better relations with the people-to-people relations. And basically, good relations with the United States would take away one of the last justifications this regime has. So I don't think he wants it, but he could be pressured into it. I think it is possible.
I just wonder whether the pressure is sufficient. I mean, we now have the United States and the Europeans on the same page, which is an enormous achievement when you think where we were perhaps 10, 15 years ago when the United States was completely alone in terms of sanctions on Iran. On the other hand, we do not have China. We do not completely have Russia. We do not have India. We do not completely have Turkey, given that Turkey is a European country but also has its own interests with Iran. So I'm wondering whether it is actually doable or whether we put ourselves in a situation where we pat ourselves on the back and say, look at all the sanctions we've imposed, but the Iranian regime survives. And we're left in with a situation where the hawks in the United States, and there are many, and the hawks in Israel, and there are many, say, well, this isn't working. We're going to have to go bomb.
Let's hope that there's never any war between Iran and Israel, because I'm speaking as an Iranian and an Israeli, and a war between these two people is a nightmare scenario for me and people who have got my background. It's like your father and your mother beating each other up. It's the last thing, so God forbid. But in terms of pressure on Iran, Barbara, again, I don't understand why Israeli leaders are complaining. The French and the British today sound more hawkish on Iran than sometimes Israelis do.
Yeah, it's true.
It's unbelievable. Sarkozy calls Netanyahu a liar, and then he is following sanctions on Iran with more vigor and more enthusiasm, and they don't have AIPAC in France.
Yeah, but Sarkozy,
the last time I checked, they don't.
Sarkozy is running for re-election, and perhaps he thinks that this tough guy image will help him.
Maybe.
You're right. No, France has been remarkably hawkish. It's been really strange. The Brits, as I said, do not seem to favor at least preemptive action, but they are very firm on things like protecting navigation, freedom of navigation in the Persian Gulf. That, I think, the Iranians have seen a firm riposte to their threats on that, and I think they know that they really can't blockade the strait, that that's just a complete non-starter for a lot of reasons. But let me go back to their coping.
Sorry, can I just say something about China?
Sure, yeah,
Barbara,
please, because China is the coping mechanism. So what can what can influence China?
Well, China seems to be influenced already. There's a report today in Reuters that China has halved on average the oil it was buying from Iran. It's almost half on a monthly basis from last year. They have stopped investing in Iran's oil infrastructure, and they are seriously reducing their oil from Iran. I don't think they're completely stopped, but that amount that they're going to buy, they're going to probably force the Iranians to pay a much lower price. But China now is not what it was before. And in terms of Russia, and here I think President Obama really deserves a pat on the back. Yes, okay, then maybe they're not completely following the Congress on this. But Russia has turned its back on Iran. Russia did not supply the S-300s. Russia has backed recent sanctions on Iran. And President Obama, he acted like a Middle Eastern merchant. It's nice to see that the Americans are learning from us. That he basically said, okay, I'm not going to get the Russians to join me for free. So you got to give something, like in the bazaar. So he said, okay, you know that missile shield that we want to build in Czech Republic and Poland, and you Russian guys don't like it? You know what? I won't build it.
Okay.
And what about that nice star treaty? Let's talk about that. All of a sudden, magic, voila, the Russians are much more with the United States.
We still have to get through the Russian elections as well, and the sort of knee-jerk anti-Americanism one sees from Putin and others.
Yeah. True, true.
Let's talk a little bit about Iran in the region, because obviously this is not happening in a vacuum. Those that I think it was Mitt Romney who said that Iran was the biggest threat to the world that we now face. I sincerely doubt that, given the situation that Iran is in. How do you see their posture? How do Israeli strategic thinkers now view Iran in light of the Arab Spring, fall, winter?
Barbara, when it comes to the Arab Spring, Iran's biggest enemy, the biggest enemy of the Islamic Republic is the Islamic Republic.
Yeah.
I'm amazed by the mistakes that they make, especially when it comes to Syria. The Iranians are not doing very well for reasons that you know as well as I do, in places such as Syria. The Egyptians are not embracing them, even though the Islamists are winning in Egypt. We don't see them coming out and wanting to follow the Iranian model. Bahrain was a bad example for Iran. Even Syria did not back Iran or Bahrain. So I think it's not going well for Iran, and even Ehud Barak says so. So, and believe you me, when Ehud Barak says something is going well with regarding to Iran, then everything must be really great.
Yeah. No, I share your analysis. I the Iranians constantly are harping on the fact that Islamists are doing well, that Muslim Brotherhood variations are doing well in all of these countries. But I agree with you. I don't see any percentage in the Muslim Brotherhood in Tunisia or Egypt or even in Syria suddenly embracing the Iranians, leaving aside the sectarian differences between Sunni and Shia. You know, these new governments that are going to be coming to power know that they're going to have to resolve the economic problems in their countries, and that means maintaining cordial relations with the West. And so there's no percentage in suddenly reaching out to an economy that's flailing and a political system that appears to be really in serious crisis. We need to find something we disagree about, since this is Blogging Heads. Maybe right. We can turn a little bit to our analysis of the internal dynamics in Iran. Will the reformists participate in any way in these parliamentary elections? Are they going to be a total bust? Who are they going to get to vote in the elections, given what happened in 2009? Are they going to have to pay people to go to the polls or threaten them?
It's, you know, the Iranian regime is very worried because these are the same first set of elections after 2009. Last year, there was in Iran, we were supposed to have city and council elections in 2010, but the regime postponed it. They said, no way. They postponed it to 2013 to take place at the next presidential elections because they were worried. But these elections, Khamenei cannot cancel them. It would be a major sign of weakness. The fact that they postponed last year's city and council elections was already seen as a sign of insecurity by the regime. I think the turnout is not going to be high, people willingly going to do it. But, you know, in Iran, I don't know if it's still the same, but when we lived there in Iran, we lived in until 87, and, you know, my parents used to take part in elections in Iran. You used to need to get the stamp in your ID to say that you voted. Mm-hmm. It's important to have that stamp if you wanted to get coupons. You know, for my family, we lived in Iran during the war. Yeah. It was important to have that stamp to show that, you know, we voted. Or if we wanted to leave Iran, it was important to have that stamp to get the exit visa. Mm-hmm. From what I understand today, in every government department, every government office, there is a department of, you know, which basically looks after these affairs, and they make sure that people vote. So I think a lot of people are going to be forced into voting. But I think Khamenei will probably be looking for a weak parliament, because as this regime goes along, I think Khamenei is basically taking over more and more of the authority away from other organizations which had some kind of a leverage and influence over what was happening in the country.
Do you think he's going to try to eliminate the post of president?
Difficult to say. I think, again, you know, predicting Iranian politics is somewhere between astronomy and algebra. It's
astrology.
Astrology also, yeah. As well. Yes, which star sign? I think if he does, it would be a mistake. It would be too soon. But he may do that.
Yeah.
He may do that. I think, you know, Barbara, there's been an amazing revelation about Ahmadinejad's gardening leave. Do you remember when he had that gardening leave last year when he went away for 11 days?
Oh, that's
11
what it was
days?
For gardening. Okay.
For gardening, that's right. So it turns out that this is a speech by a former representative of the supreme leader in the Revolutionary Guard, Mr. Zaval Noor, his name is. He basically said that do you remember Ahmadinejad had that fight with the Minister of Intelligence, right? Mm-hmm. Basically, Ahmadinejad went and said to Khamenei, if I don't get my way, I'm going to resign. Would I be able to do that? And he was hoping that Khamenei is going to say, no, you can't resign. And you know what Khamenei's response was? You're allowed to make whatever decision that you wish.
Wow.
It's up to you. Yeah. So Ahmadinejad didn't take that very well. Instead of getting the strong support, he went home and he sulked for 11 days. Then he came back with his ego a little bit lower. Mm-hmm. And we're not looking at the same Ahmadinejad anymore. It's over, really over.
No. But, you know, there's a danger. I mean, if Khamenei takes all of this power into his own hands, then who does he have to blame when the system is in crisis? You know, at least it was useful to have Ahmadinejad as kind of a foil, a scapegoat.
Absolutely. And you know what? Although I don't know this, but I think it's safe to assume that some reformists are happy by what is happening in Iran right now. with the sanctions and everything, because they're going to say, look, when we were in power, we had relations with the EU. Jack Straw came to Iran 16 times. Yeah. There were no sanctions. And look, you guys come, you kick us out, and look where you've taken Iran, and look at the situation of the country.
Yeah. No, it's a good argument. One of the things I think we should mention also, I don't think she's actually gone to jail, but the daughter of Hashemi Rafsanjani, Faizeh Hashemi, was sentenced to 6 years in prison. You know, this is somebody I've interviewed a couple of times. She was a kind of a firebrand and a rather interesting figure, protected always by her father, her very powerful family. I'm just wondering what you think that's all about. And, I mean, is there a way for these folks to have a comeback? Rafsanjani's term as head of the Expediency Council is supposed to expire, I believe, in April. Is this, you know, is he down and out? Are they really going to be able to push this pillar of the revolution completely off the stage?
You know, the joke is that Faizeh Rafsanjani is the only real man in the Rafsanjani family because of the way she stands up. She's amazing.
She is amazing.
It's really amazing. She's really, to be honest with you, it's damage control. Khamenei is trying to mitigate risk. He knows that there's going to be elections. There could probably be fraudulent accusations of fraud. At the last elections in 2009, Faizeh and the former foreign minister, Yazdi, mm-hmm. who's the one who's just been jailed?
Yes, Yazdi, again.
Yazdi. They were both very credible voices of opposition, of criticism. So now Khamenei has just decided to lock them up before the elections because there could be trouble, and he doesn't want them out there giving interviews and mm-hmm. and criticizing them.
We should point out that Ibrahim Yazdi is 80, I believe, 80 or more than 80 years old and has a heart condition. He is the oldest political prisoner in the world. It is shameful, absolutely shameful, that the Iranian government feels so insecure that it has to lock up this man. I mean, he was foreign minister during the revolution. His party, the Freedom Party, well named, has been banned ever since then. It's just crazy. I guess the chances of Mousavi and Karoubi being let out of house arrest before the election are also nil then.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. It's there is, you know, I think Khamenei is feeling very, after 2009 was I think a very scary experience for the regime. It was a very scary experience. I think I have an article from BBC Persian. I saved it from, I think, a year and a half. Again, I'm recalling my memory here that I think even Jafari, Aziz Jafari, Muhammad Ali Jafari, they call him Aziz, is quoted as saying that we were close to being overthrown. You know, ما نزدیک براندازی بودیم. براندازی means basically being overthrown. I think they really thought that they were close to the edge of the cliff. And I think, of course, when that happens, they don't have trust. And how can Khamenei have trust in Rafsanjani, whose wife, when she was voting, and there's a video of it, when, I don't know if you've seen it, she basically comes out and she voted, and they said, so madam, what do you think should happen if there's cheating and stuff? What would happen? And he says, I hope there won't be cheating. And they said, so what do you think should happen if there's cheating? And she said, people should go to the streets. So there's no trust.
There. Let's maybe sum up a little bit. What should we be doing? What should we be looking for going forward? We've already talked about a need for more diplomatic engagement. My own view is that this so-called P5 plus one, the five permanent members of the UN Security Council plus Germany, is a kind of unwieldy format, frankly, for dealing with Iran. I think there should be bilateral channels between the United States and Iran, that these should somehow be set up, perhaps discreetly, behind the scenes, because this is, let's face it, this is what needs to be done. The U.S. and Iran, trusted representatives of the Supreme Leader, trusted representatives of President Obama, need to have a discussion to see whether there really is a way forward. I think there should be an effort to prepare some realistic measures, not just a confidence-building measure, because we're beyond that now. I think the U.S. should actually provide the fuel for the Tehran Research Reactor. This would be a humanitarian gesture. This is a reactor that produces medical isotopes that help 1 million cancer patients in Iran. What better gesture, what better way to show that sanctions are not directed against the Iranian people than providing the fuel for this reactor, which, after all, is an American reactor? We should also go and provide safety upgrades for it. It's old. It's from the 60s. You know, we should be proactive in this way, and then put together a package that says, okay, if you do X and Y regarding uranium enrichment, we will relieve X and Y sanctions. There has to be a link between action by the Iranians to curb the program in a verifiable manner and action in terms of sanctions relief. This is what I think is missing, you know, from the picture. What we have is pressure. What we don't have is engagement.
Engagement, the pressure is there, and I think it cannot be ignored. I think anybody who discounts the importance of these sanctions is not being accurate. Even within Iran, you know, the Iranians are dismissing it. I think that's completely wrong.
They're not dismissing it anymore. The central bank governor actually blames sanctions in part for the run on the rial.
And also, I agree with you. You know, there some parts of what you said, of course, steps to improve relations with the people of Iran. And also, you know, I'm not happy with this sanctions against aircraft. Mm-hmm. You know, why should Iranian families who want to visit their relatives, fly in these death traps? I'm not happy about it. But Barbara, there's something here that's very important, and that for all this to happen, there is Iran also needs to contribute, Barbara. And the Iranian side has not played it well, has not played it fair. And I'm specifically referring to the IAEA questions that they refuse to answer.
Yeah.
This destroys trust and credibility. How can I, as the government of United States or UK or France, show any credibility in my approach to Iran when the Iranian government is refusing to answer all these questions from the IAEA?
Yeah.
It makes it very difficult for a rapprochement, even though I think there should be one. But I really think the Iranian government is responsible, and they should show interest as well.
I disagree with you here just a little bit. I was not overwhelmed, frankly, by the November IAEA report. Most of the charges in it were old. There was some more evidence to support indications that Iran was working on research, R&D, on a weapon before 2003. There wasn't much after 2003, and it does appear that Iran is either hiding the program better or it has scaled back on that program. And you talk about Iran answering questions. Well, I mean, one of the people they need to produce is a guy named Fakhrizadeh, who's supposed to be the putative father of the Iranian bomb. If you were him, would you appear in public, given that three of your colleagues have been assassinated, perhaps by Israel, in the last few years? So, you know, there have to be some guarantees of protection for some of these individuals if they're going to be able to come forward and discuss what they have done in all candor with the IAEA. We also have an unfortunate situation where the IAEA looks a bit politicized now. Amano, the new head, is no Mohammed al-Baradei, and that's both good and bad. I mean, it's good in the sense that he's not bending over backwards to accommodate Iran, but it's bad in the sense that the Iranians see him just as a tool of the United States. So I think that we have to be very careful that the IAEA maintains credibility and that there is a way for Iran to back off some of its aggressive posture and so on with the ability to save face. So, you know, there's plenty of blame to be laid on a number of parties. We can go back into history and talk about all the missed opportunities that took place when Khatami was president. But we are where we are, and I think the key now is to build a proactive approach going forward that combines all this pressure and sanctions with a real diplomatic path. And it may be too much to expect out of the United States in an election year, but one can only hope. And that, to
Barbara,
me, is the missing
piece. Barbara, can I ask you a
question? Yeah, sure.
Do you not think it's unfair when some people say that President Obama is doing exactly what President Bush was doing with regards to Iran? Because I think that's completely unfair.
I think it's unfair. I would say that we seem to be in some ways in a worse situation with Iran than we were under the Bush administration in terms of tensions. But no, I think that's unfair. You know, Obama did try diplomacy, but he didn't try it long enough and hard enough. And there's an excellent new book by Trita Parsi, let me give him a plug, that's out, called A Single Roll of the Dice. Basically the Israelis, at least according to this book, told Obama, you've got a limited amount of time, and, you know, if you don't get an agreement with the Iranians by the end of 2009, that's it. And so he did pivot towards sanctions very smartly after 2009. I don't think the attitude of the Israeli government has been at all helpful in terms of encouraging engagement with Iran, and that has to do with also the political pressures in this country that we see in terms of those who are very strong Israel supporters or who worry about their own re-election. So, you know, we've had a number of factors, not all helpful. Obama, of course, has turned out to be a disappointment on a number of fronts. He hasn't saved the world. He hasn't even saved the United States. But overall, I would agree that he certainly has been better than Bush, at least in terms of offering engagement without preconditions.
I think it's a little bit. I think I disagree when somebody says or anybody says that Obama stopped. I don't think Obama has stopped. The fact that Obama is still backing the 5+1 meetings with the Iranians shows that he has tried time and time again. He hasn't tried just once.
Yeah,
to be honest with you, I think the fact that today, you know, Lady Ashton has said that she wants to meet with the Iranians said we want to meet with the EU. Lady Ashton says, okay, let's meet. When are we going to meet? And they're still waiting for Iran. And President Obama, although he should be doing more, I don't think he's stopped. I don't think he ever stopped. And to be quite honest with you, I'm skeptical of the power that Israel is supposed to wield in Washington, especially when it comes to Iran. I'm not saying they don't have any power, God forbid. I'm not saying there's no AIPAC. I'm not saying that. But I don't think President Obama takes phone calls from Netanyahu telling him that you've got till 2009 to do this, otherwise it's
That's
over
exactly
for you.
That's exactly what he told him when he met Obama in the spring of 2009. He said, you've got till the end of 2009. He did. I mean, this is, you know, he wanted...
I don't think Israel is that powerful, Barbara. With all due respect of however our leadership thinks that we are powerful, I don't think we are at that level of stage to start dictating for Prime Minister of our country who gets $3 billion from your country to tell him you've got till the end of 2009 otherwise. Otherwise what? Yeah. You know, I'm not so sure.
Well, there's also a real concern in this country about the Israelis, you know, starting something in terms of military action and then, you know, coming and telling the U.S. we're going to start bombing in 72 hours. Are you with us? You know, this is what I've heard described as a nightmare scenario. Do you think the Israelis would dare to start something against the Iranians without prior consultation with the United States?
I doubt that. I don't know, but I doubt that very much, Barbara. You know, for us, it's very important, our relationship with the United States. I think also another assumption I'd like to challenge here, Barbara, is that when it comes to the military action, the supporters of military action against Iran, I don't think Israel is alone. I really don't think Israel is alone. Even though the French and the British are not saying it in public, I think it's safe to assume that they would also back it if all fails. But for Israel, to do it alone, I think would be the worst decision to do that, because I'm not so sure we have the military capability. And even if we do, and I keep saying this, when it comes to dealing with Iran, it's not just military capability, it's politics, it's diplomacy. I don't think we've got enough diplomatic leverage to do it. And more importantly, we have to think about our day after with you guys. We want to live with the United States. Yeah. We're not going to have a peaceful relationship with Khamenei. We want our relationship with you. And you know, to risk that would be so utterly irresponsible. And people can say whatever they want about Netanyahu, and I don't certainly agree with some of his policies in the West Bank, I don't think he's that irresponsible to risk our relationship.
Yeah, we haven't mentioned, of course, the economic factor, which is key, the price of oil would skyrocket, and that would hurt all of our economies. And, you know, just today, in fact, the Defense Department here is about to announce major military cuts. So, you know, they're anticipating that they will not have to be expending as much energy in your part of the world as they are now. And I don't think that fits with a war against Iran. So I think maybe we've covered it all. Are there any last thoughts?
Just one thing I'd like to say again, and this is for our conversation and for the Israeli audience also. I think when it comes to Iran, it's extremely important for the state of Israel to cover its diplomatic flank. We are right now, our leverage is lower than before. We are more isolated, and this empowers Iran. And this is something that needs to be fixed. We need to strengthen ourselves diplomatically when it comes to Iran, and it's very, very important. And I think if we do that, and if we strengthen our relationship with the PLO, we get back to the peace negotiations, we improve relations with Turkey, we improve relations with the EU, then all the focus would be back on Iran, and all the focus should be back on Iran. You know why, Barbara? Because when it comes to damaging and discrediting the Iranian nuclear program, nobody does a better job than the Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei.
Yeah, yeah. No, I would...
Let him continue.
I agree with you. Israel does need to do something about its isolation in the region, and particularly it should take advantage of its agreement with Turkey over Syria now to patch up relations.
Absolutely.
There. So I think that's very important. Well, we've solved all the problems of the world.
That's it. L'chaim to that.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's always a pleasure to talk to you. And although I cannot see you right now, I will see you shortly on Blogging Heads. And thanks to Blogging Heads for giving us this opportunity to talk about this very important subject.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Cheers, Barbara.
Cheers. So,